Hello, yeah. So I'm going to talk about some preliminary results in MR elastography. You were exposed already to the problem yesterday when Elia and Abbas gave their thoughts. And these are actually kind of combined with some of the theory I worked on and some of the theoretical and computational things that Han Wangli worked on. So, okay, good. So first, I'm going to give you a little bit of an introduction to the magnetic resonance elastography, the way I learned it myself when I was visiting Mayo Clinic, the MRE lab at Mayo Clinic. And then I'm going to touch on the fractional model of continuum mechanics that is actually something that got my attention in the last couple of, well, in the last year probably, because I'm an applied mathematician, and I'm actually looking at the mechanical properties of the soft tissues. And as we'll see today, I need something else than the classical models of continuum mechanics to describe the mechanical properties of the soft tissue. And then I'm going to present finally the preliminary numerical results using finite elements and the linear elasticity case. And this is work done by Han Wangli and with Victor Nestor in the Department of Mathematics at Penn State University. And this is going to be an interesting talk because they are pure mathematicians, so they usually need to prove state theorems and prove them. So it was an interesting point of view in that regard. Okay, so what exactly we are trying to do? So the problem of magnetic resonance elastography is as follows. We are looking for material parameters of biological materials in vivo, and we try to map them in an anatomically meaningful image that provides useful clinical information. And this is what's called an elastogram, is this map with stiffness values. Why we are so interested in? Because it can be used in clinical diagnostic procedures, in finding tumors, which actually tend to be harder than the surrounding normal tissues. And actually, this is exactly the way everything started about 20 years ago, when the medical clinicians, right, they usually palpate a region and they feel something hard and they think, oh, this is something that obviously is a tumor going in there. The medical images don't provide this kind of information, right? So therefore, this all area started to emerge where they were saying, okay, can we actually build an image that's providing this kind of information about the material properties of the tissue? And then, of course, you can use it in trauma and surgical simulations, as you have seen yesterday. And also, you can use it in design of prosthetic and protective devices. As you probably realize, the American football players are actually exposed to a lot of stresses during the games, and if you can give them a good protective device for the brain, for their head, that will actually be very good. The image modalities we can use, you can use ultrasound, and that's usually called sonoelastography or sonoelasticity. You can use the MRI, and that's the magnetic resonance elastography we are focusing on, or you can use optical elastography. What I want to mention is that depending on your image modality, your mathematical model is going to be very different. Okay, so that's one important thing that you have to keep in mind. Now, what do we have here? Biological tissues are soft materials, so pretty much are not really quite covered yet in the range of the mechanics that we are familiar with. In other words, we know pretty well how to model solids, how to model fluids, but this is a little bit still kind of a research area growing. It is difficult to measure elastic properties using conventional laboratory methods which rely on well-defined boundary conditions. And that's a problem because there are very few existing data, but in some cases they are very inconsistent. And actually, Cruz at Mayo, he ran a very efficient literature over the material properties of the brain tissue. And this is what he found. So actually, the shear modulus is everywhere. So these are a lot of authors who published material properties of the brain, and they are everywhere. So you can't actually rely on any of this. Besides that, pretty much all of this, so this is the MRE, which is done in vivo, but all of the other ones are done in vitro. And as you probably realize, especially the brain, once you get it out the system, it's degenerating very fast. And in fact, I think just a few years ago, a group in Belgium managed to show that the results of Dalford, which are probably the oldest, they were published in 71 or something like that, were actually on pre-degenerated brains. So they actually, this group in Belgium said, well, they actually run the experiments way too late to capture the proper, the properties, the correct properties of the brain. So you can't really do, you need experiments, and if you can use them in vivo, that would be great. It's actually important even if you study brain trauma, right? So even for the car industry, that's actually a very important information. So what can we image? So we can image strain, stress, velocity, amplitude, phase, vibration, whatever we think is appropriate for the experiment we are looking it in. What type of tissue excitations we can have? So we can actually compress the tissue, and that's the static or quasi-static elastography case, which was presented by Abbas yesterday. Okay, so he was actually looking at equilibrium equations. Those were the equations. However, it's very sensitive to patient motions and boundary conditions artifacts. If I want to look at the elasticity of the heart, probably I'm not going to use that. Okay, so organs that actually are moving, you can't probably do too much with the static elastography. The one that is pretty much used intensively at Mayo is the dynamic elastography. So you are applying a time harmonic excitation on the boundary, which is going to create a time harmonic wave in the tissue. And they managed to prove, so Ham Harber, he was in the biomedical, in the biomechanics lab at Mayo, and he actually showed a good agreement between shear wave dynamic MR and cooperation test in vitro on this type of agar-agar gels of different concentrations. So at least you have this kind of agreement, which is kind of nice, but it's still sensitive to boundary conditions, artifacts, and motion, and on the other hand, is requiring long acquisition time. So you want to kind of find an optimal time to keep the patient, or you know, in the scanner. And it's not only that, with agar gels, the temperature increases during the experiment. So then that's another problem, because you are doing friction, right? It's a shear wave, you are actually changing the temperature, and the conditions, of course, the mechanical conditions change as well. Another possibility is to do a time-dependent pulse on the boundary, which creates a propagated wave in the tissue. This is transient elastography. The good part is it's very fast, so therefore it's pretty much insensitive to patient motion. The problem is that it's actually dependent on the shear spatial pattern. However, this transient elastography could be very useful in studying brain trauma, for example. Okay, so that would be one way of going about the studying trauma. And finally, you can have remote elastography, where you use acoustic radiation forces by focusing an ultrasound beam at a chosen location. And this actually is used right now at Mayo to study the elasticity of the heart. So they are actually putting a lot of beams around a phantom right now and trying to figure out if they can get useful information about the mechanical properties of the heart. However, my main focus was on dynamic MR elastography, and the elastogram is going to be made of the shear wave speed. So what exactly we are doing during the dynamic MR elastography experiment? So we are recording medical MR images while a vibrating plate is placed on the skin, propagates mechanical shear waves in the tissue. By pulsing now the magnetic field in the MR scanner in tune with the mechanical vibrations, the pattern of the wave actually freezes, so the wavelength can be measured. And now, as some of you might know, the MR signals actually contains both information amplitude and shear phase information, because you are in the frequency domain. So you can use the motion encoded phase contrast based MRI and the change in the phase shifts of the flowing protons in the region of interest to create an image. Okay. Now, pretty much most of the work done at Rochester at Mayo is done in the linear regime, where they actually show that there is a direct proportionality between the phase difference field and the displacement field. In other words, if you know the phase difference fields, these shifts, right, you can immediately have the displacement field. Okay. And now, this is the, one of the experiments. So if this is the tissue you are studying, you, this is your actuator coil, the driver, and you are just moving it back and forth, right? You are trying to generate shear waves. And this is actually the imaging. So these are the imaging gradients in the coil, and this is the synchronous trigger pulses when you are actually moving your coil back and forth, and you try to synchronize these two because you want to take the image exactly in the moment when the pulse is sent through the tissue. And there you go, we have a first example here. So this is the magnitude image. So this is a phantom. It's made of a soft shell, a soft gel here, and these four inclusions here are actually stiffer. And I show you the way the waves look like propagating through. So you can actually see the way the waves go through. So now, once the displacement field is known, what we need? We need a mathematical model, right, to be able to find the material parameters. And this is a classic inverse problem. In other words, you are going to fight with probably the worst scenario in mathematics ever, how to deal with an inverse problem. Okay, so let's see what we can do here. So now I'm presenting, as I said, the stuff that was pretty much done at Mayo, so it's very different from the way Elia and Abbas are doing using the finite element. So we assume that we have local homogeneous, isotropic, almost incompressible, linear viscoelastic biological tissue. So the constitutive equation looks like this. In other words, the infinitesimal stress tensor is related to the displacement by using this relation. Okay? So that's the constitutive equation, and then what you do with that? You go back into the equation of motion, you take the Laplace transform in time, and you get the famous Navier equations for the displacements in the frequency domain, which look like this. So now I have capital letters there showing that I'm actually in the frequency domain. Okay? Lambda and M are my Lamé coefficients, and they are complex valued, right, because I assume that I'm actually using the viscoelastic material. So now we need some simplifications here. And what they did, first of all, for biological tissues, it turns out that lambda is actually has a very large value, is of order of 10 to the power 9 pascals, while M actually varies strongly with tissue pathology. So we are pretty much looking for this M, for the shear parameter, because lambda turns out to not be of too much. It turns out to be quite pretty much constant depending on the pattern. It doesn't depend on pathology. Now, biological tissues are almost incompressible, so the divergence of the displacement is close to zero, and Berlew said, hey, rho approximately equal 1 gram per centimeter cube is probably the density of biological tissue. So we are making some simplifications here. So what Oliphant did for his PhD, he said, okay, I'm not interested in lambda, so given that lambda is so much bigger than M and this is close to zero, I'm going to neglect the first term in the equation, right? You remember the first term was lambda plus M. He says, I'm going to just ignore it. Is that mathematically correct? Well, no, but anyway, you want to start somewhere. And he ends up with this very easy equation, simple equation, which he's after that just, he called it direct algebraic inversion of this equation, but it's just least square. Okay, so that's all he does. He's just inverting directly and find M. Okay? Now, numerically, this is a very tricky situation. U probably is going to have, you have some noise. You are going to have some error from measurements, and you take second order derivatives here. You are running into a lot of trouble, especially since he's not doing any regularization here. So he's simply doing the simplest possible thing for this problem. Okay. What's interesting is this speed here he used for the shear wave speed. So in 51, Oystenker came up with this formula to evaluate the shear wave speed for a viscoelastic material. So you see you actually have both the real and the imaginary parts of the shear modulus showing up there. If your material is just elastic, the imaginary part is zero, and you actually end up here with the classical definition of the shear wave speed as being M over rho, but rho in our case is 1, so it's not showing up there. Okay? And now let's see how this. The elastogram is made of the square of this shear speed. Okay? So let's see what we have. We had this example earlier, so here we have the elastogram. Okay? So it's not intensity value what we have here. These are actually stiffness values. Stiffness values are the values of this speed. So it was able to find the 2 to 3 kilopascal in the background and the 6 to 8 kilopascal here. However, the red points here are still a little bit of concern. Those are actually way higher than the 6 to 8 kilopascals. And that's pretty much a problem because you really want to be able to find somehow good, reliable stiffness values to be able to find the proper threshold between what is cancer tumor versus a tumor which is not cancer, right? And if you don't have a good estimation, you will be running into trouble. If you remember, actually, Abbas yesterday had some stiffness values for cancer tumors and non-cancer tumors, and you probably have noticed that it was quite a big difference between their stiffnesses, right? But you still don't have the thresholds, so how can you use this as a non-invasive diagnostic tool, right? For me, in particular, this is interesting because I'm still looking at the brain, and in particular because I'm part of the Center for Neuroengineering at Penn State, we are trying to build a unified model that takes into account the electric and the mechanics of the brain. So I need these values, right? And this is actually an elastogram of the brain of a volunteer. And it's very interesting to notice that the white matter is actually way stiffer than the gray matter. So that's actually a very interesting thing because it can help us understand some of the clinical conditions that occur in the brain. Okay? And now, to come back to actually what Eva was mentioning this morning, this is actually a prostate cancer data set. And usually the radiologists see this image and they will never agree where the tumor is because you can't actually see it, okay? So this is the pathological result coming from the pathology, and the pathologist said, okay, the tumor should be here. And then the elastogram says pretty much, it's pretty consistent. It's actually managed to find some stiff values exactly in the same area like that. So probably if we can actually improve this method, we'll finally get the radiologist to agree, to say all of them, okay, yes, it's actually there, right? And that would be a good enough place to start with. Now, what we have here. Okay, one way to look at the problem is we have a lot of information in our data set. However, it's challenging to extract accurate results at high resolution in complex heterogeneous tissues from intrinsically noisy data. So what can we do? Well, as I said earlier, we didn't do any regularization, and this is an inverse problem. You might want to use to combine this inversion with a regularization method. You might want to pre- or post-process the images. In other words, do all the tricks that the engineers do, throw in a lot of filters and try to get rid of the noise or anything else. Another problem is find an efficient way to eliminate the longitudinal wave effect. We are doing shear, but there might actually be still some longitudinal effect there. There is another problem here. The anisotropy of the tissues actually generates what's called quasi-longitudinal and quasi-shear waves and not the pure longitudinal and shear waves that we know in the semi-infinite elastic medium. So here is actually the first step where you are kind of start to think maybe the classical theory is not directing us in the right way. Change the constitutive model entirely. You have seen non-linearity yesterday done by Abbas. I didn't see yet any microstructure models for this. And this is actually a very interesting area, non-local models. Okay, paradynamic was actually introduced, I think, about 10 years ago by Silling, who is at Sandria Laboratories, I think. He created this model, this non-local model, to look at fractures in the solid materials. And now I'm going to actually touch and present you this fractional continuum mechanics model. So what we start with the hypothesis we made is that the information from microscopic levels is actually present in our measured data due to the advanced imaging techniques used today. However, our classic model is a macroscopic model. So it's going to take all this microscopic information and it's going to say, this is noise, I'm going to check it away. I can't deal with it, okay? So what I'm trying to say now, okay, can I actually account, can I construct a multi-scale model to somehow taking the information from the microscopic level into account? And this is what I proposed. I actually said, okay, I'm going to change the definition. So I'm going exactly the basic of the continuum mechanics theory and generalize it, okay? So usually, if you take any continuum mechanics book, it's going to say that the motion is x at t of x and t, where this function t is pretty well behaved from a mathematical point of view, that allows you to do all kinds of things. I'm saying I'm going to apply this operator, which I'm going to show you later what it is, on this t, and introduce these new parameters here, alpha I. For now, I set this function of time only, but I can play in temperature if I need, or whatever electric information I have in the brain, because I need somehow to bring the electric part of the brain inside the mechanical model. That's what, well, for the brain, okay? So I'm having the brain in mind all the time. And then what else do I need to change? I need to change the stress tensor, because the classical stress Cauchy stress tensor is very local, right? I need to make it non-local. And I'm using the same operator to do that. So what's that operator to do it? And here it comes. So this operator is actually defined using the so-called Ritz fractional integral of order alpha. So I am actually saying that I have two length scales, the macroscopic and the microscopic length, and they are connected to this type of integral and not in a linear type of way. Okay? What I want to say is that this fractional integral, derivatives and fractional integral actually turned out to be describing stochastic processes, and they are actually used already in financial mathematics. Recently started to gain a lot of interest in image processing. Needless to say that actually some of the constitutive equations for linear viscoelastic materials were actually described with this type of fractional order derivative too. However, the math is not yet there, so the mathematician still has a lot of work to do in trying to figure out what these derivatives are actually doing. What was my interest? My interest is now that I'm defining the fractional order gradient, I need some derivatives, and what I like is that when this alpha becomes negative, suddenly I have only integrals to worry about and not derivatives. And from a computational point of view, integrals are good because they are well behaved in the presence of noise, right? And I don't have to worry so much about the level of noise in the data, okay? So what's going on now? Well, take the constitutive equation back, and now look how the Navier equation becomes. So suddenly I don't have the Laplacian here anymore. I still have some derivatives, but I have this fractional order gradient where if alpha is negative, I don't have derivatives. So I reduce the order of the differentiability from 2 to 1. We eliminate lambda again in that Oliphant type of style, okay, which is, as I said, not really the right way of doing it, and we are back to this equation. And we use again the least square methods to invert the equation, and as before, we present the square of the shear wave. So let's see what we achieved here. So we are looking at the same phantom. This is what the classic model really did if we don't do any post-processing. In other words, if I leave the noise there, you see, I have a lot of strange values popping up here. Okay, so that's a 600 kilopascals. That's a lot, okay? It's almost, 10 times more than what we are actually expecting. The fractional model, so I picked up, you see, one of the components. I'm picking up for now constants because I don't know yet a function of time or anything. If one of them is negative, it is more stable. I'm actually getting the values that I'm hoping to get. And not only that, we did some mean and standard deviation for the two models, and it's very stable, okay? So I'm actually being able to recover pretty much the 10 to 12 kilopascals that is what is expected in these cylinders, okay? So they knew before what the expectation of the stiffness value should be. So it looks interesting. It looks promising. So what exactly we did so far? We proposed this new multi-scaling model, which we call the fractional model of continuum mechanics. We showed that actually it gives accurate and stable. I need some stable elastograms here without the regularization or image denoising. Because if you actually think purely from a computational point of view, that integral is denoising, right? That's what it's doing. It's a convolution, and any engineer, that's what he's doing when he's trying to get rid of noise or measurements, errors in an image. Now, what we want to do, extend this, of course, to 3D MRI, and most importantly, see how it behaves on real data, because that's one of the big problems. All the algorithms at Mayo that were developed worked beautifully on phantoms, and as soon as you get on a patient or anything like that, everything is everywhere. Okay. Now, this is an interesting thing. It will be interesting to see if this alpha of t depends on the relaxation time. So again, I'm trying to connect it back to the fact that this is actually in a magnetic field. So I have some electromagnetic fields going on there as well, beside the mechanics. Okay. And then, of course, this is actually the next step is this is not a model that is designed only for the elastography problem. It will be interesting to see if this is of any use to other problems in mechanics. Okay, so it's actually pretty general. So that was the first thing I worked on, and now I will show you what Heng Wang did. Okay, so slide show. Okay, so now finally this is, so Heng Wang was took his PhD with Victor Nestor in the Department of Mathematics at Penn State. And during the summer, I had him as a postdoc, and we said, okay, let's try to look at very basic finite elements. So in this moment, please pretend that all of you are MDs, because I told him to leave away any Sobolev spaces, any unusual theorems, which for a pure mathematician was very hard to do, okay? So you have to appreciate the fact that he went to the hassle to write in words everything. So why do we want the finite element method? Well, because it's already, that's one of the successful methods used to find numerical solutions for partial differential equations. It gives you efficient algorithms that provide accurate numerical approximations. So now we are looking for numerical solutions. And this is one of the most important things, is giving you optimal convergence rates in terms of computational complexities. And of course, it provides us with a good framework in which numerous mathematical techniques can be used for theoretical analysis. So now, very simplified, what's finite element? What exactly are we doing? If we just simply want to solve this very simple boundary value problem, right? Once I have, it has two parts. I have to make sure that I have the geometry, right? And then I have to find a weak form of this boundary value problem together with a proper domain decomposition and with some basis functions to get the solution. Okay, so this is actually the finite element solution to this boundary value problem for this domain. So you can see actually the domain is actually quite a square, right? So that's the basic of the finite element method. As you probably realize, this is where the main thing stands, besides the geometry and how you actually decompose the domain, is in what beautiful spaces you can formulate and state your theorems to get it worked, right? Okay, no theorems here, okay? Now, we are looking a little bit at criteria for the success of the method in elastography. Pretty much, actually, from what I know, Elia might be agree with me or not, I think only you and probably Abbas right now are doing the finite element for the elastography. I don't think anybody else actually got there. So, pretty much. So if you actually do a research on Google to see who is doing finite element for elastography, probably only the two of them. Okay, so it's still at the beginning, and that's pretty much because you are kind of using the models of the classical continuum mechanics to build the solution, but you also have to take into account that these are soft tissues, so then you might have to actually start from the mechanics to build something else. So what we need? We need a good understanding of the solutions from non-smooth points on the interface, and if what kind of boundary conditions we can have in this problem, and as well as how these conditions actually propagate along with the waves. Again, finite element, we need to find adaptive mesh generations for singular solutions, and also for subdomains of small detectable volumes. So we are actually going to touch a little bit this. And then, of course, you need some regularization there to get rid of the noise. So he started very easy. As you can see, this is a hyperbolic equation, constant stiffness, nothing else there, linear elasticity. He did provide us with a movie, and you can see how the waves actually propagate if you have zero Dirichlet boundary conditions. So that was actually pretty good. You have to understand that the problem he looked before for his PhD thesis was to actually, he looked only at elliptic PDEs, and that's actually one important thing here. Elliptic PDEs, it's a lot of literature out there on finite elements and everything. As soon as you go, even parabolics, as soon as you go close to hyperbolics, suddenly the literature is not there. So we actually, there is a lack, okay? So finite element did kind of develop, but the theory, the mathematical theory is not yet there, okay? So it did actually took Heng Guan a little bit of a time to actually figure out how to discretize this being a hyperbolic equation. Now, another example is, okay, now we are introducing the discontinuous coefficient in the equation. So what's going on here? Here you don't have the theory anymore, okay? So pretty much he just did the simulation of how the waves actually propagate, so you can actually see them the way they are actually going, right? So we have an inclusion there, but he still has to find the proper Sobolev spaces where this actually happens, okay? So, however, we start to look at the inversion. So we take now the direct solution, right? And we say, okay, let's invert, see what happens. In this example, he was actually able to find the 101. It was pretty, not so noisy, everything great, okay? So we didn't even add any noise here, okay? So it was just numerical solution, go back to find the coefficients. However, in this one, this was actually started to be more interesting. So now, we are adding non-zero Dirichlet boundary conditions, and we have stiffness values 5 and 50. And then, again, you can actually see the way the waves propagate, okay? So it's going to feel the fact that this is stiffer, well, that this inclusion is actually stiffer, which means that the wavelength is actually longer in that area, okay? So that's what actually you are seeing there, okay? And now, inversion. And now this is where you actually see the first time that is, we didn't add any noise in that analytical, in that numerical solution. We just took the solution and inverted, and we got noise, okay? So this is not noise from measurements, this is actually noise from numerics, okay, that's all. And in fact, I was discussing last week with one guy from Mayo. He said that at least for the phantoms, they don't get too much errors in their measurements. And still, you see that the inversion is not perfect, which means that it's actually in the numerics which you get the you get this problem. So you see, it's still a lot of work to do in even in the computational part. It's not even to doesn't have even to do with the experiment. Okay. So this is actually an, so that led us to finding a way to deal with subdomains which are actually very small. So this is these are actually three time points, three different time points, which where we are actually trying to recover the coefficients, so those 50 on the subdomain and 5 otherwise, on a very small subdomain. And you can't tell where the subdomain is because it may be here, it may be here. Where is that subdomain, right? And actually, it turns out that is actually somewhere here. So this actually has it, but this actually doesn't have it. So how can you decide what's noise versus what is actually small tumor, right? Because that's an issue, right? You are doing denoising, you are getting rid of the small tumors as well. So the first thing we actually said, okay, let's do it the most simplistic way, is threshold extreme values. So you kind of say, well, I'm not going to have stiffness values of the order of whatever, megapascals or gigapascals or whatever. You are not going to have steels or whatever strange things happening there. So you probably are going to have to get rid of some very, very unusual values there. Look over the recoveries from different times and focus on points with consistent values. In other words, you want to see that the noise is actually, that this noise is pretty much in every time point, and then increase the mesh density in the neighborhood of the suspicious point without increase of computational cost. In other words, do the refinement only on those noisy things and see what's happening. Okay? rather than doing it everywhere and being running into a problem. So this is the problem, right? So as you can see, very small region with 50 and otherwise it's 5, and first recovery, no grading, no nothing, a lot of noise, you don't know where the inclusion is, okay? So you still get the noise because of the numerical inclusion. So now what we are doing? We are picking up those, so we're going back. We are probably saying this is probably not physical, they are negative, so we are going to focus on these peaks here, which is noise right now, and say I'm going to do the recovery in these regions, right? The refinement in these regions. And what happened was it was actually able to pick up finally the inclusion. So we can actually pretty much kind of say, okay, this might actually be inclusions, this one might still actually be noise. Okay, so by actually simply doing the refinement only there. So now what we have to do, we have to understand, have a better mathematical understanding of the propagation of singular waves. Again, as I said, hyperbolic equations, especially with discontinuous coefficients, is not really there. We need to find efficient finite element schemes to solve the equations for the elastography problem. As I said before, this was done for the linear elastic case. Well, how do you go from there to viscoelastic or poroelastic? Finding mathematical models for noise reduction, in other words, now suddenly going from this to formulating as an optimization problem and going back and forth, because that's what you're doing. And finally, effective numerical algorithms to recover the coefficients and solve the inverse problem. And now he's actually working on the mathematical understanding. He wants the proofs of the theorems. Okay. Anyway, thank you so much.